It's my pleasure, in fact, to be here and to tell you about this. And so I would like to tell you about a proposal for a toy model to maybe test, in some sense, that we will make precise, the imposition of the spin foam simplicity constraints. And so as you know, maybe the main goal of what you want to do is to write down this this path integral for quantum gravity. And so I write here that this is just a statement of intent, because this is a very formal definition, and all the complexity is to give a rigorous meaning to this expression. And so here on the left-hand side, I have written some physical scalar product between two states. And the states are states of a spatial geometry Q1, so a spatial diffeomorphism class of spatial metrics Q1 on a spatial hypersurface sigma 1. And the out state is a class of metrics Q2 on a spatial hypersurface sigma 2. So this is written as a formal path integral over a yet-to-be-defined measure over the four metrics, such that the restriction of these four metrics on the boundary gives us the two in and out metrics Q. And so you know that in loop quantum gravity, we have a very nice control over the kinematical states. So these kinematical states, sigma 1 Q1 and sigma 2 Q2, are these spin network states of quantum 3 geometry. And what we would like to do, so one approach to writing this would be to project these kinematical states, so construct this physical inner product, so by projecting onto the Hamiltonian constraints. So we know in three dimensions how this works, because in three dimensions we can explicitly project the kinematical states onto the kernel of the Hamiltonian constraints, which is essentially imposing flatness of the connection, so F, the curvature equals 0. And we know that in three dimensions, the evaluation of this physical scalar product gives us the so the evaluation of the Poisson Ouredji amplitudes, in fact. So in this sense, we can claim that in three dimensions, we have sort of an agreement between the canonical quantization and the covariant quantization. So between the kinematical approach and the spin foam approach. But because in four dimensions, it's really hard to do so. In fact, we cannot solve the Hamiltonian constraint at the quantum level in four dimensions. This is why we have developed another approach, which is really coming from the covariant picture, so coming from the spin foam side. And in the spin foam picture, the strategy is to start, in fact, with what we call the Holtz-Plebansky action. And so this Holtz-Plebansky action, so S-Plebansky here, is in fact the sum of a topological term, a topological action, so which is the first term, so the BF action. And then we enforce a certain set of constraints, so with the help of a Lagrange multiplier phi. And in fact, phi here is used to ensure that, in fact, all the 36 components of the B field here, so here it's in four dimensions, so the B field is a two-form, so it has 36 components. And so the 20 simplicity constraints enforced by the multiplier phi ensure, in fact, that the B field has not 36 independent components, but only 16 independent components. In some sense, that the B field comes from a tetrad one form. So now you see that if you write the B field as a wedge product of a tetrad one form, this Plebansky action, or this Holtz-Plebansky action, reduces to the usual Hilbert-Palatini action. And so I put Holtz between parentheses here, because so the Holtz action is if we work with a finite value of the emergency parameter, and if we send gamma to infinity, we get only the Plebansky action. And so there have been lots of proposals for spin foam models in the literature. And so we could say that historically the first one, which is the Barrett-Crane model. So the Barrett-Crane model has no Holtz term, in fact. So the Barrett-Crane model would be working with an infinite value of gamma. And people realized that in the Barrett-Crane model, so these simplicity constraints, which we impose at the quantum level, are imposed too strongly. So we'll see later what this means more precisely. But because the simplicity constraint seems to be imposed too strongly, we kill all the degrees of freedom, and we end up with something that is, in some sense, not the quantum theory of GR. And then there have been other models. So just to cite these two, so the EPRL and the FK model. And these models rely on a weak imposition of the simplicity constraints. And so this weak imposition of the simplicity constraints is essentially possible because we use what we call the linear simplicity constraints. So here in the Holtz-Plebansky action, the simplicity constraints are quadratic in the B field. But there is a way to linearize the simplicity constraints by introducing some four normals. And if you use these linear simplicity constraints, we can do a weak imposition of the constraints. So in fact, there are many other models. So I have listed a few of them here, but there are many models in the literature. And the thing is that, yeah, we can ask the question, is it really relevant to try to build like new models, try to propose every time new models? And can we have like some principles telling us how we should build the models, in fact? And so, of course, like if we build a new theoretical models like this, the first two requirements to satisfy, like any new physical theory that we write, is that it should, in some certain limit, give us what we already know. So the semi-classical limit should be usual Einstein relativity, general relativity. And also, we should be able to predict something new, so to extract physical predictions from these models and possibly test them. But that would be the ideal situation. And in fact, now, with all these models, we could say that we're still far from doing physical predictions. And also, on the semi-classical limit, there is no real agreement, because it seems that all of these models, so most of them, give us the right semi-classical limit, and we don't really understand if this is because there is sort of like a, all these models seem to belong to the same class of models, and they give us the same semi-classical limit. And we don't really know how to choose inside of this class of models what could be called the right model, if there is a right model. But so another criterion would be to have just some mathematical or internal consistency, in fact. So when we build these models, we can look for certain criterions. And if these criterions are met, we can say that we have some mathematical consistency. But this has to be made more precise, because if we just say mathematical consistency, we have to decide on which points we're going to agree or disagree. And so this is what we will try to do today, try to find a criterion to see if this imposition of the constraints, so the way that we use the imposition of the constraints to build the spin-form models, has some agreement. And here we're going to use the agreement with canonical quantization, in fact. Because we know that when we quantize a theory from the canonical point of view, we have a certain set of constraints that we have to deal with. And these constraints tell us something really about the theory we're dealing with. And so we're trying to ask today if, when we do the spin-form approach, how do we compare really the way we handle these constraints with the canonical approach? And so, in fact, a very important point is that in the canonical theory, the simplicity constraints, so which I call the primary simplicity constraints phi, so these are the quadratic simplicity constraints enforced by this multiplier phi here, these are second-class constraints. And so it's precisely the fact that these constraints are second-class that makes that the Barrett-Crane model was sort of failing, because we were imposing second-class constraints strongly. And this was also the motivation for looking for a weak imposition of these second-class constraints. But in fact, it turns out that these simplicity constraints are second-class precisely because they are conjugated to secondary constraints. So there is a pair, in fact, of primary constraints and secondary constraints, and these primary and secondary constraints together form a second-class system. And so I think that the way I understand this is that the usual point of view is that if we think about the naive phase space path integral, so which is the first path integral written here, so here I have removed all the contributions coming from first-class constraints, because for this discussion, I just want to talk about second-class constraints, primary and secondary second-class constraints. So if I want to include first-class constraints here, I have to add additional Fadeyev-Popov type determinants and also gauge-fixing fermions and everything. But here I don't want to talk about this here. But if you write this path integral, usually we're going to have contributions, so delta functions of the second-class constraints. So here I have primary second-class constraints, so phi, and secondary second-class constraints, psi. So we have to impose, in some sense, a delta of the second-class constraints. And also there is sort of a measure factor coming from the square roots of the determinant of this Dirac matrix between the second-class constraints. And here I have written the path, the action, so with the total Hamiltonian H0, which usually for in GR this Hamiltonian is 0. There is no total Hamiltonian. And so in fact, the usual point of view is that we can sort of forget about the secondary constraints, because there is a trick, which is due to Eno and Slavnov, which enables us to, in fact, go from this phase space path integral to a Lagrangian path integral, in which we remove the contribution from the secondary second-class constraints. And so there is a way to do this. And when we do so, we end up with this form of the path integral, in which here we have added in the exponential the primary second-class constraints, this Lagrange multiplier lambda. We integrate over this multiplier. And then the measure that we get when we do this procedure is now a local measure, so in the coordinates, phase space coordinates p and q. And this measure has been computed in the literature. So it has been computed for the Plebansky action and also for the host action. And so the computation for the Plebansky action was done by Buffenoir, Eno, Nui, and Roche. And again, for the Plebansky action and for the host action, the computation was done by Engel, Han, and Thiemann. And in fact, what we obtain is that this measure factor, so in the Plebansky case and in the host case, is given, in fact, by, so this curly V is the four-dimensional volume, and this straight V is the three-dimensional volume. And so the question we want to ask is, in fact, it seems that this procedure is not always available to us, because it seems that when we look at correlation functions, we can find like some class of Lagrangians for which this trick is not going to work. And also, the question is that even if we do so, when we have these measure factors here, these measure factors depend also on the secondary second class constraints. So there has been a discussion in the literature about the fact that if we can write a spin foam model, but without using the trivial Lebesgue measure for the Lie algebra elements and the Haar measure for the group elements, but by using the measure, so this measure that we inherit from the canonical analysis, this is going to affect the amplitude of the lower dimensional simplices. So namely, the phase amplitudes and the edge amplitudes. So even from this point of view, we see that it's important to see what we're doing with the secondary second class constraints. So yeah, we can ask what is the influence of this measure factor on the phase and edge amplitudes. And so.
It's fun to do that, but it's still a point of view.
Yeah, it's a point of view, yeah.
If you take your first class constraint and second class constraint. So the point of view is, either you treat the second class constraints as fundamental, so you impose them classically and then you quantize, and this is what you present. Or you treat this second class constraint as non-fundamental and just a gauge fixing the first class constraint. And in that case, you don't do that. In that case, you don't do the measure.
Yeah.
So it's not like, this is the point of view. It's just that here you're taking the point of view that you should first reduce classically and then quantize. And then, some other people could argue, well, that's not what you should do. You should first quantize and then reduce, which is how to measure. Mm. Of course, there's a slight difference.
Yeah, so there is a difference. And a good question to ask would be, can we really quantize this difference in some sense? Can we see
it's just because in some of the papers,
what the difference is?
Alexandra, they always said this is the right way.
No, yeah, but there is no, I'm not claiming that there is a right way, of course. This is.
But they do claim that a lot.
Yeah, these are
it's
only.
Just that, and then you could argue the reverse, that the right way to do is first to not think of the constraint classically. Hmm.
Yeah. But so. Yeah, so we can agree on the fact that we can say, okay, either I ignore my secondary second class constraints or I do something with them. And so we're going to try to exhibit a model in which when we take these two directions, we're going to end up with very different results. And so this is the question again. So the first question we raised already is how to properly impose the primary simplicity constraint, which is the question we ask when we build usual spin foam models. This was the problem addressed by Barrett Crane, by the EPRL model, by the FK model. And then the other question is it legitimate to forget about the secondary second class constraints? And so maybe one way to answer to this question, or both of these questions, is to try to find models of the form, so the theory with action S1 equals the theory with action S2 plus a set of constraints. And if we can find a structure like this, and if it turns out that the theories S1 and S2 have known spin foam quantizations, what we can do is try to do the spin foam quantization of S2, impose the simplicity constraints at the quantum level C, and see if we get the spin foam model for S1. So this is just a recipe, but we're going to see if we can exhibit such models. And it turns out that both in 3D and 4D, such models exist. So we're going to study here the three-dimensional realization of this proposal.
But then you could also do that for drawings anyway. You could also first reduce and then quantize, or first quantize and then reduce.
Yes.
Could you do that?
But you mean reduce by the second class constraint? Are we going to see that? Yeah.
We could compare, like, yeah. Reduce first and then quantize, and quantize and reduce.
we're going to see in the end how this, what happens when we do this. So this is the outline. First, I'm going to introduce the, maybe it's too bright. So the classical theory, then just outline the strategy, and then two points of view on the quantization, the quantum theory, and then conclude. And so the classical theory, so the starting point is that we consider a three-dimensional action. So this is in three dimensions. And this action is a Plebensky action for the gauge group SO4, in fact. So this Plebensky action for the gauge group SO4 is just the usual BF term. So where B here is an SO4 valued one form with one space-time index mu. F is the curvature of some SO4 connection. And I'm using this multiplier phi mu nu to impose this simplicity-like constraint. So this is the formal analog, if you want, of the four-dimensional Plebensky action, SO4 Plebensky action. And so it turns out, the nice fact is that just like in four dimensions, the simplicity constraint imposed by this multiplier phi is of this form. And so this simplicity constraint has three sectors of solution. In fact, five sectors, because there is also sine plus minus. And so there is a gravitational sector of solution, which I call, in which the one form B A J mu has this expression in terms of a four vector XK and a triad EL mu. There's a topological sector in which I take the Hodge dual of this expression, and there's also a degenerate sector. And so you could see that hand-wavingly, what happens if I take the gravitational sector and I plug this into the action? So the simplicity constraint is going to die because simplicity constraint is solved by this gravitational sector. And then this first term, so B wedge F, so trace of BF, if I go to the time gauge, so if I write this vector of F4 XI with components 1, 0, 0, 0, what I get is a usual action for SU2 3D gravity. It's just a caveat, which is the fact that in this curvature, in fact, there's going to be components of the curvature. So I'm going to see components of the connection, which are of the type omega 0 I and omega 0 j. But in fact, these components are Lagrange multiplier, and you don't see them at all. So this action reduces really to the action for 3D gravity.
But in 4D, you don't have SO5. In 4D, so here you're breaking also
SO4,
right?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Yeah, this is breaking SO4 into SU2, yeah.
People are looked at 4D and 4D case with
SO5? I don't know. No, I don't think so. There is a 4D realization of this, but it's not based on the same ingredients. I'm going to tell you what the 4D version of this is, in fact. But here, yeah, really here what the simplicity constraint is doing is breaking the gauge group from SO4 to SU2. And just if you do some rough counting, so just that we agree on what happens, you see that the initial B field, so B A J mu, has 18 components. And I have six simplicity constraints, so constraining the 18 components of the B field, so which gives me 12 components in the end. But you see that if I write the B field in terms of this vector X and this one from E, here I have 16 components, because I have four components here, and I have 12 components for the one form. So there seems to be a problem in the counting. But in fact, this is due to the fact that these solutions have additional symmetries, and these symmetries are just rescaling of the normal vector and of the one form, and also this shift symmetry. So these are four symmetries. So the counting is the same, so I get 12 components in the end.
What kind of theory you get in the topological sector?
I'm going to tell you. Now we're going to see what sort of theory we get in both sectors. And so to see what we get in both sectors, what we can do is just focus on the SO4 BF part. And now imagine that I take the SO4 BF part and I use the self-dual, anti-self-dual decomposition of SO4. So I split this action into the self-dual part and the anti-self-dual part. And then imagine that if I vary both of these parts with respect to the connection, I'm going to get the torsion-free condition for the B field. And if I solve the torsion-free condition, we get the torsion-free connection, and I plug this back into the original action, I get to the second order action, in fact. And so just if I do this, what happens formally is that the second order action takes this form. So it's the sum of two, again, we could say, anti-self-dual and self-dual actions, where in fact here the metric g mu nu plus minus is defined by this internal product. So the dot is the product in a the SP2 indices, so of these self-dual and anti-self-dual components. And in fact, the sign factors here, S plus minus, are just the sign of the determinant of these 3x3 matrices. So now if I compute this explicitly, now I can say, OK, I take a B field, which is in the gravitational sector, so epsilon XE, or a B field, which is in the topological sector, and I compute the metric, and I compute the sign factors, and I look at what happens. So it turns out that if I compute the metric, I see that in both sectors, both the self-dual and the anti-self-dual metrics are equivalent. So the four metrics here are all the same. So in the topological sector and the gravitational sector, and the plus and the minus. So all the metrics are the same. And this we could call the two-dimensional version of the Urbanka metric. And we know that what happens in the 4D Plebensky theory, usually we say that the Plebensky constraints ensures that we're dealing with a metric theory. But in fact, already at the level of the Plebensky action, we already have a metric. And this metric is cubic in the B field. And this is called the Urbanka metric. But the Urbanka metric has many, many components. And so the simplicity constraints are just ensuring that we deal in the end with 10 metric degrees of freedom. So here, in some sense, the same thing happens. I can construct this 3D version of the Urbanka metric, which is just quadratic in the B field. And I can see that all these metrics are the same in both sectors. And if I look at the sign factors, I see that in the gravitational sector, I have S plus equals S minus. In the topological sector, I have S plus equals minus S minus. So if I plug this in this action, in the gravitational sector, this is just 2 times the action for gravity. In the topological sector, this is 0. So it's a trivial theory. So in some sense, from the very beginning, when I have this SO4 BF theory, in some sense, because SO4 is 2 copies of SU2, I already have SU2 gravity, or 2 copies of SU2 3D gravity. But here I want to forget about this thing, and I want to really impose this reduction of the gauge group by using the simplicity constraints. And why you want to use these simplicity constraints? Because yeah. So okay. So here, this is vocabulary. So here I call gravitational and topological, but it's all topological in some sense. In the sense that this is 3D gravity, but it's all topological. But if you want, this gives me like a real action, and this gives me just 0. So in this sense. So this would be twice topological. This would be gravitational topological. This is really because it's 3D gravity. But the next thing is that if you look at the canonical structure of this action, so you take this three-dimensional SO4 Plebensky action, you do the canonical analysis, and the nice feature is that it mimics exactly the situation in the four-dimensional theory. So the canonical analysis of the 4D Lebensky theory was carried out for the first time by Buffet-Noir, Eno, Nouy, and Roche, and then by Sergei Alexandrov and Kirill Krasnov. And the difference in these two approaches is that, so the first version, so in this canonical analysis, they use a version of the Plebensky action in which the simplicity constraint is imposed on the SO4 indices. And you can also have a version of the simplicity constraint imposed on the spacetime indices. So these are two just dual formulations of four-dimensional Plebensky theory. And so what happens is that, so I'm not going to go through the entire canonical analysis, but just tell you what is interesting for us, is that, so the 36 phase space variables, so the connection and the and this one form, are subject to first class and second class constraints. And so there are 12 first class constraints, sorry. And so these constraints are, as usual, SO4 gauge symmetry, space-time diffeomorphism, and also constraints telling me that, so in fact, when I work with the B field contains the lapse and the shift, which I treat as dynamical variables. So it's normal that in the end, I end up with first class constraints telling me that, in fact, the momentum conjugated to the lapse and the shift are vanishing. So these are the 12 first class constraints. And the 12 second class constraints, so there are constraints on non-dynamical variables, but the interesting second class constraints for us, which are the exact analog of the second class constraints in the usual 4D Plebensky theory, are the primary, so simplicity constraints. This is just the spatial part of the simplicity constraints. So epsilon AJKL, BAJA, BKL, B. And it turns out that this primary simplicity constraint is conjugated to a secondary simplicity constraint. So if we require that this constraint be preserved under time evolution, we get another secondary constraint, which has this expression. So this is a constraint involving the connection as well. This is a constraint only on the B field, and this involves the connection because they have the covariant derivative here. So there is this symmetric expression.
So in total, how many first class and second class constraints?
So in total, if I do the counting, 12 first class and 12 second class. So 36 minus 12 minus 12 minus 12 equals 0. So this is.
Okay. Can you go back before? There's something that doesn't match. Yeah. So here you explain that there are six constraints, right?
Yes.
Okay. And then four symmetries. So what it means is that out of the six constraints, four are generating first class, and two are second class. Right. This is what. So this is what I was saying before. Whether you, so you should recover. Of course, there you're doubling the number of things because you're multiplying two. But this is where the key difference is. Either you treat these constraints as it is, and then you don't care about the extra four symmetry, which are going to be the gauge of it.
Mm.
Or, you know, this is what, let's say, the region treatment of the paper here. Or you somehow gauge fix these four symmetries and introduce the, you know, another measure to. But I don't recover this 6 plus 4 splitting in your late analysis. Because this is really the difference between the two treatments. Either you treat this 4 symmetry and gauge fix them, or you treat this 4 symmetry and you compute the volume of the gauge. So can you recover this 6 plus 4?
I don't know, in fact. I mean, I think that if I were to mimic what we usually do in the spin foam approach, I would take the Hamiltonian point of view and look at the.
Well, it depends. I don't know what we use here. It's just take the six constraints and forget about the four symmetries.
Mm.
Because the four symmetries are part of the action.
Yeah.
So you can do it at the Lagrangian level.
But I agree, but that's in some sense the question. You know, what happens if I forget about the other constraints, or what happens if I deal with them? So what happens if I...
You can do it here. Either you engage the symmetries, this four symmetries.
Yeah.
It seems to me the key thing is what do you do with this extra four symmetries.
Yeah.
So in your latest analysis, can you tell me which one is the generator of these four symmetries?
It's probably the, I would say that it's the this guy's, in fact, vanishing of. Because this essentially tells me that the other symmetries tell me that I can normalize the x vector, and I can choose a e mu 0 equals 0 if I want. So I can choose my lapse and my shift however I want. So I would say that, but I'm not sure. But still, you know, I have a Hamiltonian theory. I can try to build a spin foam model by just imposing these constraints and see what this gives me.
If you only cover these four plus six, at least what you use for the new
lab. Yeah, I have to think about it. I'm not sure.
Because if you want to analyze the other option, you have to try to get that.
Yeah.
Which here it's completely lost.
No, I agree. And so, in fact, it turns out that the secondary second class constraints. So, what I can do is write, we're going to see this later, a linear version of the primary simplicity constraints. And if I fix the four vector to be just a fixed normal, I can combine this linear simplicity constraint with this constraint to get this constraint on the connection, where P here. So it's the projector onto the boost part of the connection.
Where is your linear simplicity constraint?
So, here, no, here it's not here, but I'm jumping ahead of. So this is just to make contact with what happens in the canonical analysis of the usual Holst action outside of the time gauge. Because if we look at the Holst action outside of the time gauge, we can work with what we call the Lorentz covariant extension of the Escher-Carbo-Barrow connection. And it turns out that this Lorentz covariant connection satisfies the constraint of this kind. So you see that if I fix x to be a constant vector, this tells me that the boost part of the connection is 0. So in some sense, I only see the SU2 part of this connection. And this is the reason for which when you build the quantum theory with this Lorentz covariant version of the Ashtekar-Barbero connection, we recover the usual SU2 kinematical theory. So this constraint, in fact, is the same one as this one. And here it's normal, because here what this is telling us, this is in fact telling us that I'm not dealing with SO4, but with SU2, in fact. So this is, for me, the reduction from SO4 to SU2. This is why this is going to be important at the quantum level after. And so if you have this picture in mind, we can suggest the following strategy. So the strategy could be to study this diagram. So we start with an SO4 BF theory. And we know that at the classical level, when I've solved the simplicity constraints, I get the action for 3D gravity. And then I know that the spin form quantization of the action for 3D gravity is the Ponsonner-Reggie model. So it's this state sum for gravity. So the proposal is that I can now do the spin form quantization of the SO4 BF theory and try to impose the simplicity constraints at the quantum level in the way that this is usually done in the usual spin form models and see what this gives me. So in some sense, the whole idea is that we know what we need to obtain. So then we can discuss if this is a legitimate strategy, because we can say, okay, what does tell me that this is just a recipe, in fact. Nothing tells me that this is what I should do and that this is really a good consistency check. But okay, this we can discuss, but. No, but from the point of view of what we do in 4D, you know, in 4D we start with something that is not gravity. We say that classically I have constraints which ensure that I'm dealing with gravity. Then I quantize the non-gravity part. At the quantum level, I impose these constraints. And I, wishful thinking, I hope that I recover the partition function for gravity. So in some sense, the diagram is the same. But the only thing is that.
I find in the system, there are theorems. It's
yeah.
So it's always that example where it goes to
you. You must tell that theorem.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it's always but we have to be silent.
Well, but sometimes when you reduce, you have some that you get visualized if it's.
But there's, let's say, there's a mathematical theory when you like really system constraints are well defined. So it's called Gilman's theorem. Mm-hmm. It's a precise technique dimension.
So with
information?
Yes.
Yeah. The thing is that they don't commute in the sense that the equivalence map. So they commute in the sense that there's a map which is invertible into quantization, but they don't commute in the sense that this map is not necessarily unitary. So it's invertible but not unitary, which means that you can extract all the information from one to the other. It's a contraction map. So that's why. If you put naively the same state, you don't get the same result.
Yeah, so the obvious.
Which is sometimes people forget that. It's a funny, there's lots of statements about quantization and communication. They do.
Which is the assumption. I mean, you said the assumption.
Yeah, in the way, well, the case is what people have looked at, which is essentially you need a Kerr manifold and a constraint, which is positive.
Yeah, but that's very specific. I mean, yeah, it's very.
Well, T star of P is. No, it's huge. It's an infinite class of examples. And it's finite dimension.
Yeah, so this would be the first obvious criticism to this, is that, okay, even if it does not commute, to which extent does it not commute? Can we still find, if you end up with something which is not, so here the Ponsonner-Reggie model, maybe it's still valid in some sense. So, and we know, in fact, so this endpoint here is a Z-gravity, so the Ponsonner-Reggie model, which has this expression. And we do just the usual spin form quantization of the SO4 BF theory. So it's the same thing as the Ponsonner-Reggie model, but factorized as using the decomposition of SO4 into 2 SU2. So I have these weights on the faces, dimensions of representation J plus J minus, and this product of these two 6J symbols. So what we want to ask is, how do we impose? So if I try to mimic what we usually do in the spin form models, is try to impose simplicity constraints at the level of this partition function and see if I recover the Ponsonner-Reggie model. So now the quantum theory. And so to build the quantum theory, so I'm going to discretize the theory first. The discretization is, as always, I have this one form B, which I integrate along the the links of the simplicial decomposition, which are dual to faces F. So I label this guy with F, in fact. So these are SO4 valued fields. And if I look at the discrete version of the simplicity constraints, I have this diagonal simplicity constraint. So F are here links, which are the same. I have this cross simplicity constraint, so for links that just share an endpoint. And then usually I also have to add the volume constraints. But we know that if we have the volume constraint plus the closure constraint, or rather the volume constraint is implied by closure constraint plus this constraint. So we usually forget about the volume constraint. And so, so this is the quadratic version of the simplicity constraints. You see that these constraints, they do not separate between the topological and the gravitational sector. Because if I change B for star B here, I get the same constraints. And so now if I use the linear simplicity constraint, so the linear simplicity constraint just tells me that if I fix this normal vector xi, which is the one that enters in the definition of what we call the simple one form. So the linear simplicity constraint is just xb equals 0. So I forgot the equals 0 here, but understand that this is the linear simplicity constraint. And in fact, this linear simplicity constraint selects for me the gravitational sector and breaks the SO4 gauge group to the SU2 stabilizing this normal vector. And so now what we usually do in spin flow models in 4D is that, so these are primary simplicity constraints. So the Baird-Crane model imposes these two constraints strongly. Okay, and the EPRL model, so here I put L in parentheses because technically the L is for gamma different from zero, and here I have no gamma. But this doesn't mean that I cannot do a weak imposition of the constraints if I have no gamma. I can have no gamma and do weak imposition of the constraints. And we'll see in this example that it gives something funny, in fact, for a very precise reason. But the Baird-Crane model, so okay, impose one and two strongly, and the EPRL model imposes one strongly, because one, in fact, can always be imposed strongly. So the diagonal simplicity can always be imposed strongly. And the constraint three, so the linear simplicity constraint is imposed weakly. So we're going to follow these two routes and see what the model gives us. And so just as a remark, are we going to see this later, but you see that another criticism of this approach is that since I'm in 3D, if I use a real simplicial decomposition, so with three valent edges, so with three valent intertwiners, sorry, there is no real cross-simplicity constraint because the cross-simplicity constraints are constraints on the intertwiners. And so if I have three valent intertwiners, there's nothing to constrain, in fact. They're all the same up to a normalization factor. And so in fact, it looks like we have a cross-simplicity constraint, but in fact, we have no cross-simplicity constraint. But we're going to answer this criticism as well. And so another way to solve the constraints at the quantum level, so the first constraint, you see that if I write it in terms of the discrete B field, so which are generator of SO4, the first constraint tells me that I have, in fact, only simple representations. So J plus equals J minus equals GF. And if I write the decomposition of SO4 into a sum of SU2 irreducibles, if I have the simple representations, I only go from JF equals 0 to 2JF. And in fact, what happens between Baird-Crane and EPRL, so the difference is just that the Baird-Crane model selects the lowest weight subspace, so the J equals 0 spin, and the EPRL model selects the highest spin subspace. And so this you can see that if I impose the linear simplicity constraint in the time gauge, if I use X, which is 1, 0, 0, 0, this tells me that the boost part of the B field is 0. If I impose this strongly, I get Baird-Crane. And if I impose this constraint weakly, it means that I use the master constraint. So instead of imposing boost equals 0, I impose a square of the boost part equals 0. So if I impose the square of the boost part equals 0, I select only the highest weight subspace. And so all this to say that now if I want to build the partition function, I can represent this imposition of the constraints. So I'm going to do it graphically because it's, I understand it better like this and it's much faster, but I can represent this imposition as in fact, so here you see I have six strands. And so this in fact is only three strands that I have split into SU2 left and right representations. This is why I have six strands. The small box is the integration over SO4. And the big box is the imposition of the constraints. Okay, so now I write the partition function and I impose these constraints. So if I impose in the spirit of the Baird-Crane model, So first I see that when I impose the diagonal simplicity constraint, I have j plus equals j minus. This is going to give me a dimension of the representation j squared. This is already not the right phase amplitude of the Poisson energy model. Now if I look at the vertex amplitude, so I just represent what happens at one phase between two tetrahedron here for simplicity. So here you have this integration and imposition of the constraint. So what the Baird-Crane model does is that Baird-Crane projects onto j equals 0. So here in the middle, I project onto the lowest dimensional subspace, so j equals 0. So I separate everything. And then I integrate here over SU2 left and right. So if I integrate independently over SU2 left and right, I get the product of two 6j symbols. And so in this sense, if I do this strong imposition of the constraints, here I get a 6j squared for each vertex. And this is not looking like a, unless this has a funny property that the square of this is the Poisson energy. I mean that this is, but I don't think so. So this is not the vertex amplitude of the Poisson energy model, and this is not the phase amplitude of the Poisson energy model. So you could take two points of view here. You could tell me, okay, so the vertex amplitude we obtain by, usually we claim that this encodes the dynamics, so we don't have a 6J here, but maybe this is not a problem because if you look at the semi-classical limit, I'm going to get the same thing. But what is maybe more important is the phase amplitude, because we know that the topological nature of this model is encoded in the fact that the phase amplitude has to be the dimension of the representation and not the dimension squared. So this is really troublesome. Now if I forget about the strong imposition and I try to do the EPRL imposition, so I write the same partition function. So here again, diagonal simplicity is going to tell me that j plus equals j minus. So I get dimension squared here. And then here, the EPRL, so the projection, I don't project onto j equals 0 like Baird-Crane, but I project onto the highest weight subspace, so onto the 2j representation. So if I do this, I project onto the 2j. And in fact, the EPRL projector, constraint operator, does two things, in fact. So first, it projects onto the highest weight subspace, and then it integrates. So it's this additional integration. So it does a group averaging, in fact, to get rid of the, because when we do this, in fact, we project onto an SU2 subspace. And so then we have to get rid of this SU2 information. And this is done by group averaging. So there's a residual integral here. So this is my EPRL implementation. So I project onto the 2J representation, and then I integrate. And you see that now if I integrate in the middle here and here on the strands, so here for each vertex, I get again a 6J squared. So here I get 6J squared. And in between, so between two vertices, so on the faces, I get a fusion coefficient.
So you don't get C squared.
If I integrate.
That's not the.
Huh?
Yeah, you don't get C squared. You just get the C squared.
Why? No.
You
if I don't tell it like explicitly that these two are the same, which is what the additional constraints are going to do, but this is.
Yeah,
because you integrate after.
If
you
want to reintegrate after, and then in the middle, this is. Yeah. If you forget the two bars, then you just get the suggestion. Extra two bars.
Forget that. Are you
subscribed to here? No, the left is one. Yes.
Yeah, of course, but this is going to be the case after, but at this step I cannot ignore them because my measure on SO4 is just giving me two copies of SU2 and I get the squared of the. At this step there's nothing. In fact, you're going to see that later when we impose the secondary simplicity constraints. They tell us that the left and right SU2 are the same. So then they have a delta of plus minus, and then they have only one integral. And then they have the 6J. And so here I get in between these fusion coefficients, so just like in the 4D EPRL. So the only difference with the 4D EPRL here is that so I could include the image Z parameter, so I would have an additional dependence. So this 6J would be, the J plus would be something like 1/2 of 1 plus gamma j, and the other one would be 1 half of the absolute value of 1 minus gamma j. And the fusion coefficient would also depend on the intertwiners. But here, since this is 3D, I have no dependence on the intertwiners. This is why also here in the sum I have no intertwiners. And so you see that, it's something that I'm still confused about, but people, so you can see that this EPRL implementation of the constraint is not a projector, in fact. So if I impose EPRL twice, I don't get, so the square of the projector is not the projector. In the sense, it's not a genuine projector. And so the way to make it a projector is to renormalize it. And you see that the renormalization factor is just this 9j symbol, which is this fusion coefficient. So this fusion coefficient is just a 9j symbol. If I replace this EPRL implementation of the constraint by 1 over this fusion coefficient, you see that if I do the same work, so with this renormalized EPRL implementation of the constraints, I get the same thing without the fusion coefficient. So I get what I obtained before doing the Bayer train model. And this is the manifestation of the fact that in this model, there is no off-diagonal constraints, because all the intertwiners are three-valent, so there is no constraint on the intertwiners. The constraint on the intertwiners is just a normalization factor, which is this 9J symbol. So the difference between EPRL and Bayer train is not encoded in the off-diagonal constraint, because there is no such constraint. So it's just up to a factor, it's the same thing. So in this sense, this reduces to, unless I had an emergency parameter. If I put a gamma, then it's not the same thing. But if I have no gamma, this gives me Bayer train. And so now what happens if we take into account the secondary second-class constraints? So I remind you that these secondary second-class constraints are generated by the preservation under time evolution of the primary simplicity constraint, the spatial part. And so the most straightforward way to deal with them is to go to the time gauge, this vector. And if you look at the expression of this, so this is the, I remind you, it's a trace of a, it's trace. B0 star BB and symmetric in these guys. So if I go to the, I can again split this into self-dual, anti-self-dual, then go to the time gauge in which both the B plus and B minus are equal. And then I see that this constraint is just telling me that omega plus equals omega minus, which is what's telling me, in fact, that I'm dealing with SU2 and not with SO4. And so the graphical way to implement this constraint is now by, I'm replacing this integration by a black box now, which is an integral over, so again, three copies of SO4, but with a new measure, which takes into account this discretized secondary second class constraint. And so this is, again, the implementation of the primary simplicity constraints. So this I don't change. This I can do, again, the Bayer-Crane version or the EPRL version. But now I have to modify the measure over the holonomies. And so this discrete version, the next thing is that in this model, you can exactly discretize this condition, and this condition is just stating that the holonomies left and right are the same. It would be a G, sorry, so an H. So the holonomies are the same.
That's just
strong. Huh? Yeah, that's just, yeah. Strong. But this is still a weak in the sense that, I mean,
okay, it really works, but there's something bizarre is that, you know, because you're mixing two pictures here. You're mixing the Lagrangian picture, which is space time picture, with an Hamiltonian picture, which is, you know, so in the Hamiltonian picture, I impose one constraint at time t, and then I have to preserve this in time evolution. So I have to say c dot is equal to zero. So then I get this other thing. But if I'm in the Lagrangian picture, and I'm imposing c equals zero on all slides, I don't need to impose again that c dot equals zero because I'm imposing c on all slides. So that's the thing is that in the Lagrangian picture there's only one constraint. In the Hamiltonian picture there's always two.
Yeah, but then
because,
I could
because imposing the constraints at all times is the same thing as imposing constraints.
Yeah, but then I could say why this EPRL prescription that I used before, which is supposed to impose it at all times, is not doing the right model.
Which one
Why?
You see the time derivative when you impose c at all time, you impose c dot.
Yeah, I agree, but then I could ask why is this a weak imposition of the primary constraints? If I just do this, why does this does not give me the Poisson energy model?
Which one?
This implementation. See, if I usual point of view is that I just do this, okay, and then I can ask, is this doing is this consistent in some sense? Is this doing the work for me?
You're mixing two pictures, the Lagrangian, you use the language of the Hamiltonian picture, and then you impose the constraints on some timeline things, which are, so it's completely, I mean, it's the same criticism I would say of EPRI, which does this Hamiltonian, it's a mixture of language. I think there's one huge confusion. So, EPRI, the analysis you did before was not an Hamiltonian analysis. So it's kind of, right? Because you impose a constraint in modeling.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, so this is going to work, but I mean, yeah, I could still argue that. So the usual point of view is, from the classical point of view, we know that all we have to do is solve these constraints. In fact, this is what we do. And the usual argument in Ford is that once we solve these constraints, at the classical level, we have gravity. Then at the quantum level, we only impose these constraints. But if I naively try to do the same thing, I'm just mimicking what we do in Ford. If I do the same thing and I mimic, I just impose this constraint, I don't get the right result. So. No matter, like, independently of which picture I want to think about, and if I try to do the same thing, I don't get the right result. You know, so. Yeah. So the right result I call the Poisson Reggie model. Then we can discuss if this has to be what I expect or. If I were naively doing this, if I were starting with F of R, the BF theory, and trying to impose the simplicity constraint as we usually do in for these spinful models. If I were doing the EPRL imposition, I wouldn't get the Poisson Reggie model. So then I could say, okay.
Maybe to stay in the background, we should deal with the volume constraint. Because in fact, you said that the volume constraint is automatically satisfied when the closure and the but this is a classical development. And here you are using the same argument to say that it's a classical event. Okay. In fact, it has been shown that if the simplicity constraints are involved at all the stage, then it's not in the secondary.
No, I think what has been shown by Terence Simonet is that if you impose diagonal of diagonal enclosure, you imply volume constraint. I don't think they said anything about the secondary constraint. I'm not sure.
Yeah, but I think it's quite confusing because here you are really using the secondary second class constraint, but you have here when you use the canon for the approach. Well, normally in spin form, you are supposed to.
Yeah, I
mean, that's why that it's not what we are trying in practice. So maybe that's why.
I agree, but I mean, the construction is still confusing because if I'm just imposing part of the constraint, like I would do in 4D, I don't get what I expect in some sense. What I expect from the classical argument, which is this theory reduces to
theory. Yeah, but what you can do is go back to the discrete action. You can get the same result there by imposing just one constraint. Well, maybe future, but you know the thing is that
So yeah, we'll give another point of view after. Maybe you will clarify. So okay, now I replace this integration by this new measure on the holonomies, and then there's another question we have to ask now: is how do I still have to deal with the primary second-class constraints? So how do I impose them? You can see that I'm not showing it here, but if I impose them again, strongly as Bayard Crane would do it, I get something completely degenerate. Here, I just get the weight of these bubbles here. So I get the product of. But so I have to impose them weakly again in the EPRL sense. If I impose them weakly now, so I project again on the 2J subspace, and then I have an integral here. But since these are two SU2 strands are the same, I can, by invariance of the Haar measure, I can move the integral from here to here, and I have this one integral here. I do it. I have the SU2 here and. And then I just get the weight of these bubbles here in between. And the weight of these bubbles is 1 over DJ1, 1 over DJ2. So I get this 6J symbol with this weird coefficient here. I still don't get the right phase amplitude, but I get this 6J here. And so If I use the same argument as before, if I renormalize now this projector, this imposition of the constraint, such that it's a genuine projector, I get rid of this factor, and I get the 6J symbol. But I still don't get the right face amplitude, but I get the right vertex amplitude at least. So still a problem with the face amplitude.
You mean you don't get the right, the other one over the 6J?
Yeah, I don't get the face amplitude right. I cannot.
But you can explain, okay. There's another way to explain this difference between depolarization, which is as from the Lagrangian perspective. Which is so now for every this edge here, you have a bivector, right? Initially, so you're in so force, so there's a bivector. Now the bivector, in fact, there's not one bivector. There are three different bivectors, right? Because you can look at the bivector in the defined in the intersection of the phase. The bivector centered that face, or you can parallel transport like the bivector on the right tetrahedra, or the bivector on the left tetrahedra. Right. So these are the things. So the first model you impose is the model where you impose at the you put that the bivector located at the face is simple. Right. And the second model you impose is the model where you impose that the bivector of the left center on the left tetrahedra and the right tetrahedra are the same. That's the difference. Mm-hmm. So you could also do that as a kind of artifact of this presentation. So
okay.
You see?
Yeah.
It's just that the same bivector can be transported on the left tetrahedra, the right tetrahedra, or it would be
in the center.
And then
but short
amount
equivalent. I mean,
you said that. I mean, the one where you pose two parallel phase, you pose two constraints, in some sense, other one where you pose the constraints and you preserve it in time. It makes sense. Whereas the one where you pose only one constraint, so it goes with what is.
Yes, yeah, so obviously I can have many different interpretations of this, and the question would be, how do we really understand this? So especially at the 4D level, where things are even more complicated. So why? This is something I don't understand. But
well, but what I'm saying is that it's not there's discretization. The thing is that classically you have one V variable, but at the discrete level, in the continuum, you have one V variable at one point. But at the discrete level, you have like two V variables. Or you're confused about it, what B is. And B depends on the connection or not, depending on where you're located.
Yeah, exactly. But this is also
so that's really always an artifact of discretization. But when you have discretization, you always take one plane and in fact you double it. It's always
This is
there's the plane before and the plane after, which is always what's going on.
So another manifestation of this is, in fact, the fact that at the discrete level, there is no clear distinction between primary and secondary constraints, in fact. Because if I put this additional transport of the B field with holonomies, I'm also going to constrain the holonomies. And the question is why we can have these different points of view, and why, what should be the, I don't know if there is a white or right point of view, but why there is a, we get different models. Can we understand?
So
then two things. Okay, so if I renormalize, I get rid of this factor, and then for the phase amplitude, I could say as before. Usually, we say that the phase amplitude is can be modified by the measure that I put on my holonomies or on my B field. So I think this measure is only going to depend on the B field, and which I inherit from the canonical analysis. So if I put this measure factor that was in the first path integral, which I get from the canonical analysis. So this measure factor is going to change the phase and the edge amplitude.
Well, so this measure factor breaks the symmetry between time and space, so it's completely bogus.
No, why?
It's a measure factor that would be the area and it breaks the measure factor that anyone would be confused. It's not a 4D environment.
No, but this is always about. So
well,
the I agree that the measure factor depends on.
So you don't have a splitting between time and space.
Yeah.
So you're not going to recover.
No, but
you cannot. The measure factor difference is not something which breaks the symmetry.
No, but the fact that the measure factor depends on the 4 and the 3 volume is the fact that just diffeomorphism agree with the gauge symmetries only on shell. This is always the case.
Yeah,
we always have a measure.
You don't have the difference between 3 and 4.
There is not covariance.
Or 2. Here you have the difference between 2 and 3. I'm just saying that the measure difference you have is not, it's still invariant under the rotation.
Yeah.
So maybe, isotropic. So you're not going to reabsorb such a thing by the non-isotropic. You can reabsorb it?
I think you can reabsorb it, yeah.
You haven't shown it?
No, I haven't shown it, but.
What?
I haven't shown it, but I would like to
but
show
how
it.
How can you reabsorb an isotropic measure factor into something which is not isotropic?
I don't understand what you said. It's not isotropic.
This measure factor doesn't use any splitting between 2 and 3. So the measure factor that Eno and the other guys compute is something that explicitly, uses slicing. So there's something which is 2-dimensional and something which is 3-dimensional. So and then it's not symmetric. Time and space are not treated the same way. Here, the measure factor you have is completely symmetric under the exchange of time and space. So, I'm just putting two and two together. You cannot take care of something symmetric by something which is not symmetric.
No, I agree with this, but I could still argue with the fact that what is really important, for example, here in 3D is really, so for the topological nature of the model, to get the right phase amplitude. So what I could do is really by hand say, okay, I'm going to modify the measure by hand such that I get the right weight here. And this could be a prescription, which is just, I put any strange measure by hand and I try to recover the right phase amplitude. Because this is not going to, by doing what we usually do and writing the dynamics and getting the vertex amplitude, we're never going to constrain the phase amplitude. And in 3D, what is really important, it's not really the vertex amplitude, it's really, in some sense, the phase amplitude. So we could, by hand, change the measure in such a way that I get the right phase amplitude.
Could,
then I don't know if the...
It's a non-local change of measure. Yeah. Something that depends on the number of beams around the measure. It's not something which is as,
low-code at the vertex, which is a product of dimensions. What happens to the take 2? As a take 2, let's just take another point of view, and this point of view of just simplicial discretized path integral. So if I write the path integral as a product over the phases of this modified measure, so a measure on the B field, these fluxes, and then I use here a star product and commutative to glue the vertex contribution. So there is this gluing is dictated by the structure of the complex. I choose a reference tetrahedron and I glue everything together. And then the vertex amplitude here, AV, is given by this expression, so this measure on the holonomies and this exponential of the discrete BF action. And here, so this G, UF, and GDF, minus 1, are the holonomies going from the, I've removed the dependency on the vertex here just for the sake of clarity. So this would be a holonomy going from the vertex V to UF, and UF is the tetrahedra. So UF and DF are the two tetrahedrons sharing the face F, so in 4D. And so here, what we can do is write this with two modified measures, in fact. And there is lots of arbitrariness here because I could write a measure on the B field and a measure on the holonomies, and I could by hand put here a delta of the discrete primary second class constraint, the usual simplicity constraints, and here I could put discretization, so like we did before, of the secondary second class constraints. And here I put a mu discrete, which would be a discretization of any volume factor coming from the canonical analysis. So either I do a discretize the Antiman angle, Buffon-Noir, Nui, and Roche measure, or I put any measure factor by hand such that I recover the right phase amplitude. This I don't know.
I don't, because here we are really doing the true Lagrangian approach. You don't, so why do you need the secondary approach? Because it's the point from Timas.
But here, depending on what I put, I don't know if I'm doing Lagrangian or because.
No, but not really, because if it's really Lagrangian, you don't need. So the issue with the EPI model is that they mix Hamiltonian and Lagrangian approach. So okay, you can ask the question: do we need to implement additional constraint here in this approach?
Okay.
Because secondary constraint, come from the Hamiltonian.
Yeah, I agree, but you know, the first function that I write in the second slide, the first one is written with a delta function of the primary and secondary constraints, and I can take this as my starting point, you know, this phase-space path integral, and try to compute this discretized version for this.
Yeah, but I think you should not, maybe the thing is that, that's what I was saying before, you should no longer use this primary thing. There's no primary and secondary constraints in the Lagrangian, that's what you're saying. There's only primary constraints.
But this is not Lagrangian.
What?
This is not Lagrangian.
So, yeah, now you're Lagrangian. So in the Lagrangian setting, there's no primary and secondary constraint. There's just the constraint. But what we just said before is that at the discrete level, now there's the constraint before the surface and after. So there's still somehow two constraints. They're both, none of them is primary and none of them is secondary.
But it's more constraint.
But it's more that you have
on the parallel transport.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You say that before and after parallel transport is the same.
Yeah. It's more, it appears also in that Bianca is doing that when you discretize the initial data, what you really are doing is that you need to double the phase space and define the initial, you know, data before and after. So in the discrete case, somehow in the discrete case, you're like doubling the phase space. And you have to take care of both.
So
there's a phase space just before and the phase space just after. I agree with this, I completely agree.
But it's just that, okay, I agree, but especially because of also what I said before, that we know that in the discrete setting, there is no clear distinction between this primary and secondary. So we should not say this, but for this example, it turns out that if I want to start from the other hand here, so from the vertex amplitude, and glue all the contributions together such that I recover the Poisson regimen with the right phase amplitude, with the right phase amplitude, the constraints that I have to put are just a discrete version of what corresponds in the canonical analysis, the secondary second-class constraint, and to the primary second-class constraint. Then in the four-dimensional case, if I were to do the same thing, of course, I don't know what to put here and here. This is a, we could debate over like which measure we choose. But in this example, this is what we have to do. We have to put these two constraints, discretized version, in this example. But yeah, of course, I don't know what happens in the four-dimensional case and if the same thing should be done. But in this example, this is what should be done. And so all this to say that if I take this vertex amplitude now, which is in the B representation, can do a Fourier transform to get to the holonomy representation here, where you have this GF, it's an additional holonomy dependence here so that I use for integration. And I have this expression to evaluate, and it has been shown, in fact, that this vertex amplitude in the holonomy representation can be written as a sum, in fact, an expansion over projected spin networks. And the weight, in fact, so is what we call usually so the usual vertex amplitude in the spin form representation. So spins here, so lambda f and jef. I'm going to tell you to what they correspond. And so the generic formula, the generic expression of this, the generic expression of this vertex amplitude, so the most general form in some sense, is this arbitrary measure over the holonomies. So here I can choose, put any discrete contribution. And here you have the projected spin networks. And so JF is the representation of the full unconstrained gauge group, so SO4 or SL2C. Because projected spin networks are spin network states in which, on the links, I put, for example, an SO4 representation. And then for each of the nodes of the spin network, I have this discretized normal XE here. And then at each of the target points, I project onto an SU2 subspace. So this gives me representations JEF. And so in fact, this is the most generic form that you can write for the vertex amplitude. And the EPRL model, in fact, corresponds to the choice where this measure is just the usual Haar measure. And the representation J lambda F, so which is the SO4 representation, or the SU2, or the, sorry, the SL2C representation, is completely determined by the SU2 representation, so by this J factor. And this is the relation between the SO4 representations and the SU2 ones, and the SL2C and the SU2 levels, and the emergency parameter. And so now if I work this backwards, so there's a lot of calculation involved, but if I compute this, in fact, putting here, so in this measure factor, I discretize the secondary simplicity constraint, the secondary second class constraint, I evaluate this spin network and this amplitude, and I glue everything together. So the partition function, when I do the gluing together, that I get here, the result, is really the Poisson regimodel with the right phase and vertex amplitude. So if I use this prescription here, and I try to work backwards, I get the Dupont's Norvegian model with the right phase amplitude.
Which prescription?
So if I start with this object, I evaluate this.
So what is the prescription?
I evaluate this vertex amplitude here. So this is the speed, the evaluation on the vertex spin network on the boundary of this. This is the boundary graph of a four
simplex.
No. This is just a, sorry. Forget the. This is just a remark. This is just a remark that.
So what do you take as a game to recover the right model?
This is just a remark. So the right model is in 3D. If I want to recover the Ponson-Norvégien model, I have to implement my secondary simplicity constraints, just like we did before, and I can do this by modifying the measure here again.
So what do you have to take?
So the measure over the holonomy is here. So in the measure over the holonomy is. I discretize the secondary second class constraints. I evaluate this guy here, and I glue the contributions together, and I get the application function.
Can you show us the measure, the X of G?
It's not here, but the X of G is the same thing as the same measure as before, in fact. It's this one. It's the same.
But you just showed the new word.
Hmm? No, but here, in fact, here it's going to work, so for a reason which is a bit different. The reason is that if I write the partition function like this, see that if here the measure over the holonomies, I use the measure which is delta of g plus g minus minus 1. At the discrete level, I can already solve, I can already impose this delta function, so this constraint on the holonomies. And so this trivially, in some sense, reduces to the partition function for SVT reality, so to the Ponson-Norvégien model. So it's because we can solve the this. I would have, I mean, we can discuss it after. I can show you the.
So you have a product of two delta functions with g plus and g minus?
Yeah, here. So here in this measure over the holonomies, I can put a delta j plus g minus, minus 1. This is just to say it. It's essentially saying the same thing, but it's another, it's not the graphical version of the version in which I evaluate this vertex amplitude with this projected spin network. And so maybe.
I mean, because in the first previous version, you could get the right model by just putting a one of the DJ in your projector. So, you know, this just the normalization of the projector is changing the normalization.
Yeah, but this is what I'm saying. Like, when I compute this, I could put, like, normalize differently, I could put different measure factors. And
yeah. You could do that previously.
Yeah, I agree. But in the four-dimensional case, maybe if we start with this, which we usually use to evaluate the vertex amplitude, so this is what we do for the EPRM model, maybe I can do the same thing and try to choose a measure factor such that, but the thing is that I don't know in the four-dimensional case how to choose this measure factor, because if I want to choose it like I choose it here, because here I say, okay, if I choose the measure factor as the discretized secondary second class constraint, I get the Ponson-Norvégien model. But in the four-dimensional case, I cannot discretize the secondary second class constraints. So if I have to choose.
That's why you can take the point of view and say, but you can impose the constraints that the D is after and before the D.
Yeah, but then there's an arbitrariness in how I choose this. But I agree. But then the question would be, how do I find in the four-dimensional model really the.
Here you were saying that the arbitrariness is low, it's still there, right? It's still there.
It's still there, but. But yeah, I could choose arbitrarily. Here it's still here, but I know what to put for my new measure in some sense.
But do you know what to put in the model, or you know what you call the second?
Yeah, I know, but I don't know if it's a coincidence or not. You know, I know that the natural thing to do is okay. I'm going to put the discretized version of my secondary second class constraints. And this gives me the Ponson-Norvégien model. But I don't know if this is a coincidence because it's a 3D model and everything is much simpler. And but this is what I don't know. And this is why. So, yeah, I don't know why it's the case. So this is why I don't want to claim that in the four-dimensional model, this is what we should do. Because if we try to do it, we cannot do it. Because we cannot discretize the secondary second-class constraints at the four-dimensional level. Because these constraints involve the spin connection, gamma of E. So there is no discretization of these constraints. So in this sense, I don't know what to do in the four-dimensional case, but maybe we can play with this and But yeah, this is the open question. So I can conclude on this. So again, the restriction of this model is that there is no non-trivial diagonal specific constraint. This is because it's a three-dimensional model and you use the simplicial decomposition. So all the intertwiners are trivalent. So there is no real constraints on the intertwiners. And again, it's 3D. But in fact, there is another version of the same trick, in fact, in the four-dimensional case. And the trick in the four-dimensional case is to extract the degenerate sector of the Plebensky theory. Because we know that in the EPRL and FK model, these models also contain a degenerate sector. And we can extract this degenerate sector. And at the classical level, in fact, from the Plebensky point of view, the way to have the degenerate theory is to relax the condition of tracelessness of the Lagrange multiplier. So then we impose 21 constraints and not just 20. And the additional constraint is that the volume is equal to 0. And so this was done recently by Alexandrov. So in the four-dimensional case, we can do this. And what happens is, again, that SO4 is broken down to SU2. So it's an embedding of SU2 BF theory into SO4 BF theory. And so in this four-dimensional example, the argument is the same. The argument is that if I construct the partition function of the SO4 BF theory and I try to impose the constraints a la EPRL or Barrett train, I get something which is not the state sum model for SU2 BF theory in four dimensions, even though we have non-trivial diagonal simplicity constraints. So yeah, the question is if we can use this example to test other proposals for spin for models, because in literature we have lots of proposals for implementing the primary simplicity constraints. And so we could test these proposals on this example and see what the result is. And so yeah, the important question is what should we do with these secondary second class constraints in the four-dimensional case? And also what we could check is what happens with the emergency parameter but in 3D now, because what happens is that, so if you take usual SU2 gravity, so three-dimensional gravity, we cannot include the emergency parameter because essentially the way we can include the emergency parameter in 4D or here in 3D is that the gauge group is SO4, so we have two traces on SO4. We have the trace with this BF and the trace with the star inside. So if I have access to this other trace, I can put the 1 over gamma in front and construct this term here. In three dimensions, you can only do this if you extend the gauge group by doing Trans-Simons theory, which is what I think Valentin and Etera did. And so then they can have an emergency-like parameter, but it does not behave as in 4D in the sense that it does not disappear on shelf. And so here you see that in the three-dimensional case, because it's SO4, I can put an emergency term. And for the same argument that I gave in the beginning, this term is completely irrelevant at the classical level. Because if I am in the topological sector, so in the gravitational sector, I won't see this parameter. In the topological sector, I don't get zero, but I get just a rescaling of Newton's constant by 1 over gamma.
Are you able to see the difference between the topological sector and the RB? You talked only about one sector, whereas there should be two ways to impose a constraint.
Yeah, I don't know what happens with the...
I mean, in EPRL, we know the two ways.
Yeah. No, here I don't know. But so yes, we can, for instance, generalize this to include the emergency parameter. And so maybe if we take this action as a starting point, we can either do canonical quantization or spin foam quantization and test the issues we have at the four-dimensional level with the emergency parameter, see what happens in the three-dimensional case. So for example, we can, from the canonical point of view, we could try to compute, for example, the geometric operators and see what the spectrum becomes on the physical states. Because we could solve here, since it's 3D, and solve the physical scalar product. To see what happens with the emergency parameter, if it disappears at the quantum level or if it does not disappear. Or if there is a preferred choice of quantization which makes gamma disappear at the quantum level. And that's it. Oh, you mean in 4D? No, I don't know. No, what I mentioned when you first asked the question is that to do this in 4D, it It's not by going to SO5, but by still taking SO4, but the degenerate sector, degenerate Plevinsky. And then SO4 reduces to SU2. But I don't know if you can do SO5. Okay. But maybe. Yeah, but first the question is, can you have a classical theory which satisfies for the first requirement so that you know the spin foam quantization of the first one, then you impose the simplicity constraints, and you know the spin foam quantization of the resulting theory. And I don't know for SO5 what would be, because maybe if you were thinking of things like McDowell-Mansouri, for example, the first problem would be even if you try to do the spin foam quantization of this, how do you impose the constraints, you know, that I don't know if there is any known spin foam quantization of this, this thing. Yeah, I could. Yeah. But then the question is, which constraints reduce SO5 to another theory that I know how to quantize a spin foam? And then the other question is, once I know these constraints, how similar are they to the constraints that we deal with in usual spin foams, you know? Because you want to be, in some sense, able to compare. You know, if you have a set of constraints and a Hamiltonian theory which is completely different from what we usually deal with, there's no real way to compare, you know? I'm not saying the comparison is 100% clear here, but it's more, you know?
So you have one way, is there at least one way where you can get the right model, or so far there's no way? There's some hope that there is a way.
In four dimensions?
In three.
In two dimensions, there is a way.
Which one?
Which is by writing this starting from this.
Yeah, but it you said it's not, but you didn't show it.
No, I didn't show it, but. I can show you that.
But it's something different than just imposing G plus from G minus, because previously
it
doesn't work.
Yeah, but it previously doesn't work because we impose it in a different, you know, this is. It's really the way we impose it is not really the same.
So, can you tell us how you impose it?
Well, here the discretized version is going to be the same, but the thing is that the model is not written in the same way, you know, so.
So what do you impose? You
don't
impose G plus plus.
Oh, you impose
G plus plus. So what do you do?
I
didn't. It's the same model
initially. Yeah, but it's.
It's a 4B,
so. Yeah, but I don't know really, because, you know, from the very beginning when I write this, you know,
whatever you do there, I mean, if it works, then you should be able to translate in that
direction. I don't know how it translates, like, really. I don't know how it properly translates.
See what is, so clearly, you're not imposing G plus equal G minus, you're imposing something else.
I don't see how it translates here, but.
Original
BFR,
or what is this?
Yeah. Interesting, but no, I don't. It's not clear.
Thank you very much.
All right.